This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Mira Sivasodhi. As a society, we don't like to talk about death. So we sort of dismiss palliative care as only for the dying. But with the right public approach to palliative care, we can improve the quality of life among a significant proportion of the population who are living longer with chronic non-communicable diseases. Joining me to co-host is Azrul Muhammad Khalib in our public health series on palliative care, CEO of Galen Center for Health and Social Policy, and joining us also Dr. Ednin Hamza, CEO of Hospice Malaysia. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
You know, what value, I'm just going to very quickly start with Ednin. Maybe you want to share with us what value palliative care actually brings to society, and where are Malaysians when it comes to palliative care?
I think that's a very pertinent question, and that's something which I often get asked. What's the point of palliative care? And one of the things that comes to mind is that we don't really think about things that may affect us until that's when we want to. An analogy I would probably look at is if you're going to travel from here to another place, and in Malaysia we tend to use our public transport and cars. And you think, what is the essential component of that? And you have your engine and you have your wheels and your steering wheel, I guess. And that may hopefully get you there. But it'd be nice if you had air condition, you had some music, you had brakes and safe seatbelt as well. And that, in a sense, is what palliative care does in healthcare. Most of healthcare is very disease-specific. So you have cancer, the oncologist looks at what is it that we can do with the cancer. They're less inclined to look at the symptoms that are associated with cancer. You have pain, you have problems breathing, you have feeling a bit depressed, anxious, fearful. Who's going to look after you? You have doubts about your purpose in life. Who's going to do that? That's where the palliative care comes in. So it works in synergy with the people dealing with your disease-specific treatment to hopefully improve your journey in dealing with your healthcare.
You know, we're running a Twitter poll at the moment, if you'd like to get involved. We're asking, should people with terminal disease be given end-of-life care? And we have 85% of people who are saying, yes, they want to for quality of life, and 15% who say, no, it's a waste of money. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
That's unfortunately a slightly misinformed judgment. They say it's a waste of money, but in so many studies, palliative care saves money. There's a lot of aspects of medicine that cost money, and it actually causes further suffering. We sometimes talk about physician-assisted suffering, where the treatment that we give actually will cost quite a bit of money. It doesn't meet the goals that it's supposed to, and it makes you suffer as well. And what has been shown is palliative care reduces hospitalization, improves quality of life, improves symptom control, actually meets most of the preferences of the people who want it. And it costs a lot less money. So I'm not sure why you would want to deny a product that would actually enhance life and cost less.
Well, I just wanted to pick up on a few points there, but one main point that we very often hear about is the terms. You know, we have hospice care, we have palliative care. You mentioned palliative care several times now, and that's basically what the show is about. But we also hear hospice care, we also hear end-of-life care.
Yes.
Could you perhaps share with us a little bit what's the difference between these terms, and, you know, is there a difference in the kind of approach that we take towards these streets?
Yes, it's kind of a mix-up of terminology. The word hospice came from the Latin hospitium. It denotes a situation where travellers come to stay. And the word hospitium is a root word for places such as house, hotel, hospital. And hospice was a place initially for travellers, and then it became a place where people who were sick were staying. And hospice care started sort of over 100 years ago, popularized in the UK mainly. And then the Canadians got involved, and in Quebec. And the word hospice in French wasn't very nice. And so they used the term palliative care. Okay. So the term palliative care and hospice is actually the same. But gradually things also continued to evolve. America doesn't like the use of common words, North America, so football is soccer. So in that sense, there are some preferences. So hospice in the US is slightly different from the rest of the world. But in Malaysia and the rest of the world, hospice and palliative care are the same. Now, what does it involve? The traditional domain of hospice or palliative care has been mainly towards the terminally ill end-of-life situation. But gradually over the years, what has been found to research is that the approach and the application of palliative care is applicable even at the start of a diagnosis of a serious illness.
So chronic disease also possible to be included?
It is also possible, not entirely, but... And that's why what has been suggested by public health is that a palliative care approach actually may be better than a disease-specific approach because it looks at the person's goal of care rather than the disease goal of care.
So, but when do you decide that a patient is at the end of their life?
When you're born, yes. That's the beginning of your end of your life. One of the things that is still not completely recognized properly would be that when would this be? And sometimes it depends on the resources that are available. One of the ways in UK that has been quite useful was the use of a surprise question. And it was asking a GP to think when they saw a patient in front of them. Would I be surprised if this patient was still be alive in front of me next year? And if this GP or doctor thinks that, well, there is a chance that this person may not survive, that person really does need palliative care.
Already?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Or even at the start of diagnosis, when I trained in the UK, when I was working in the medical ward, when we diagnose a patient with cancer, they would see two people. They would see an oncologist and they would see a palliative care person. The oncologist would say, well, this is the cancer that you have. Let's think about the treatment that we have. Maybe surgery, maybe chemotherapy, maybe radiotherapy. The palliative care would say, now what has this done to you? Are you getting pain? Are you feeling depressed? Who's going to look after you? And so the two things together deals with the person and the disease. So I don't get involved in what treatment will help to change the cause of the disease. But I'm very interested in what the disease has done to this person.
How do you decide then? I mean, that's a very difficult decision to make, really.
It's not. It's asking you what's important for you now.
Okay.
So it's very patient-centric.
It is completely patient-centric.
When we're looking at this approach, but rather than a disease approach. But I'm curious about a point that you mentioned just now, the way it's done in the UK, where you have the surgeon and the palliative care specialist there together.
Yes.
In comparison to what we have here in Malaysia,
yes.
I mean, how is it? Are we similar or no, do you only see palliative care much later?
We are not similar. The UK recognised palliative care in the 1980s. They were doing things before that. There are hundreds and hundreds of services in the UK. We are at a very much lower level of resources there.
Why do you think that's the case? Has it got to do partly with culture as well?
You could say that. You could say that in a way. In terms of what do we want our young medical professionals to aspire to? There's glamour in certain specialties and there's less glamour in specialties like palliative care. And we've had people that have come to work with me who felt that that when they say to their friends, I'm working in a palliative care setting, they will say, doesn't that make you feel depressed? So there is this, I guess, negative culture perception that palliative care is not sexy. It's not glamorous.
Definitely not.
So, I disagree with you. I think it's great.
I don't know whether it's made for everyone. It really depends.
Yeah. It's not made for everyone, but I think it is one of the most enriching areas of medicine you can actually be involved with.
Why is that?
You learn about people. You learn about life and humanity. Then really about diseases and drugs and the nature of you know, how treatment modalities are going to change the course of a disease. I think that's important. But through the hundreds or thousands of patients that I've come across, I learned to appreciate the value of life in a way that I didn't when I was working purely in hospital-based environment. In working in KL, I've met with families who tell me a lot about the historical nature of KL. I've met people who have descended from the early settlers, and they tell me the history. And you find yourself knowing so much more about the community, your culture, than you could ever read from the history books.
I'm just thinking then every doctor should actually serve in palliative care at some stage.
Yeah, at some stage.
I'm filled with the stories of the people I met. And one of the things, the legacy of some of the stories I use in my teaching. And one was a young lady who said to me that, you know, my doctors talk to me about all this disease, about my cancer. They don't know me. And so when I talk to a patient, I will usually start by asking, tell me about yourself first, because I need to know you before I learn about your disease and how the disease is affecting you. Because it is you that I need to know, what your preferences are, what your goals are, what you like and what you don't like. And only then can we start thinking about what medicine is acceptable or not acceptable to you.
So consultation has to be together with the medical professional as well as
the person is alive. The disease is inert. And so you have to communicate with the person, not with the tumor or whatever else that's infecting this person. The hemoglobin may be 5 or 7. That's just a figure. It is the patient who's feeling breathless or weak because that hemoglobin is low. And that's the person I want to talk to. Not the X-ray chart, not the form that has got all the blood results.
Okay.
Certainly a different approach to medicine.
Yes.
I have really not heard before, honestly. I'm starting to hear Zen.
It's not rocket science, you know.
No, but really, this is perhaps
it's just
so much
awareness,
more humane.
Yeah, to think in a different way, really.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So anyway, we're discussing palliative care or end-of-life care with Dr. Ednin Hamza, CEO of Hospice Malaysia, and co-hosting with me today, Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. If you have a question for us, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We have a Twitter poll running at BFM Radio. Should people with terminal disease be given end-of-life care? We're still standing at 85% who say yes for quality of life, 15% no, it's a waste of money. Get involved. We'd like to have your thoughts. Coming up next, we'll find out more about hospice care and, you know, understanding this gap between your oncologist, perhaps. And, you know, the myth is most people go into hospice care because of cancer, and that is not the case. We'll come back and find out more up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Mira Sivasodhi. In our Health and Living segment today, we are discussing palliative care. It's the second part of our public health series. How can we do better in this area? Co-hosting with me, Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. Joining us also, Dr. Ednin Hamza, CEO of Hospice Malaysia. Very interesting take on palliative care. Azrul and I are very enlightened by this perspective of what end of life really means. And, you know, we're running a Twitter poll. What do you think? Should people with terminal disease be given end of life care? 85% still saying yes for quality of life. 15% saying no, it's a waste of money. Our phone lines are open. It's 03-77-109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. There's a lot of stigma attached to palliative care. Dr. Ednin, you want to go through that with us as Malaysians?
Yes, there's a huge amount of stigma to palliative care. The common ones are things like, I don't want palliative care because I don't want to give up. That's quite common. Another one is that I don't want palliative care because I'm not poor enough. It's only for poor people. I don't want palliative care because I'm not dying yet. And there's still treatment options that may be available. And those probably are the most common ones that come to mind.
Okay.
Have you heard the more fatalistic ones, which is mean I don't really need to do anything. God has decided that this is how it should be and nothing can change that?
Yes, that sometimes comes up. People say, I don't want any further treatment because this is my fate, and therefore I will subscribe to whatever fate I'm given.
Yeah, but, you know, we've spoken at length concerning palliative care, and I'm tempted to ask, is it really recognised in Malaysia in terms of the medical treatment? Do we have a framework in place? Speaking about policy, you know, is it under the Ministry of Health? Is there something that we could refer to as a plan or policy?
Usually when you think of palliative care, you think of Hospice Malaysia.
Yeah.
Is it available?
A private sector, yes. Basically, right?
Correct. Yeah.
I think I've been involved in palliative care in the country since 1997 when I came back from the UK. And I'm quite grateful that the ministry has actually taken an interest in palliative care and has actually recognised it as a medical specialty about 10 years ago, 2005 or so. And we now have got some training programmes in palliative care, and I teach in about 5 universities to both undergraduate and postgraduate level. But it is small, and you know we've got hundreds or dozens of universities and there's not enough of people teaching. The difficulty we have is that it's actually amongst our own medical colleagues. That's one of the areas to deal with.
The stigma, you're
the appreciation of where palliative care can be involved within the healthcare industry. Our colleagues in the medical fraternity sometimes don't understand it very well. So they sometimes may say, well, you don't need palliative care yet, without really knowing what it is. And then we have got the public who, again, don't really fully understand that. So we have a great deal of ignorance about how we deal with it. In terms of a policy framework, we are working on a national palliative care strategy. Mm. But that tends to be within healthcare services. What we actually don't have is a public healthcare awareness. You know, just like we talk about anti-smoking and various other things, there's no public campaigns that are really out there that hopefully informs the public as to what they could have by palliative care. The other thing which I would want to see being addressed in the country are actually issues of quality and standards. Mm. Because palliative care is becoming a bit of a buzzword in the healthcare industry. Many of the private hospitals want to get accreditation, and many of these aspects, international accreditation, includes palliative the availability of palliative care. Many nursing homes say they have palliative care, but when you then ask what does that mean, then you might be faced with some silence.
Okay, and this understanding that most patients who come for palliative care or accept palliative care are those, you know, with cancer. That's not really the case, is it?
That has been historical. Quite a bit of palliative development has been within cancer areas. And in a way, cancer is going to be quite easy because you have a very easily predictable disease trajectory. But the overall need for palliative care actually in Malaysia is cardiovascular disease. And then you have your kidney diseases, your respiratory diseases, basically any organs that are crucial to you that you actually can't get a spare part.
Okay. And it's hard for donation and stuff like that.
I mean, we're told that, at least in Malaysia, that 4 in 10 Malaysians are basically needing palliative care each year. That's 40%, right? So that's basically around, 56,000 people annually? So we're told in the same report that less than 10% are actually accessing this.
Roughly, so, yes.
Yeah. So the majority are not accessing palliative
it,
care.
Yes.
So who is able to access, and who is the most in need of palliative care? I mean, you just mentioned a breadth of people that, in terms of disease.
I guess it depends on mainly the dominant aspects is the locality of where you live.
You mean whether you're in the city or
whether you're living in an area that has got palliative care services, and whether you are accessible to hospital-based services or community-based services. So if you were in KL, you're quite lucky. But if you were in one or more rural areas, you're not so lucky.
But we hear very often that many of these services are more private sector driven. They could be in private hospitals rather than public. The public hospitals don't seem to be the first place that people want to go, but more likely a nursing home or a place like Hospice Malaysia would be the first thing that people think about when they want to access palliative care. I mean, what is the state of palliative care in the country?
I guess it's basically because we actually don't have a portal well enough for people to get such resources. Hospice Malaysia certainly puts up in our website places, other places where they can get palliative care, but we need to keep updating it. There are continued developments and services coming up in government hospitals. There are a few private hospitals that provide services. I would not want to comment on what happens in nursing homes at all.
Sure.
So, in a guess at the moment, because we have no issues of standards and quality, people have to just keep asking where they can get such services. If you're in the Klang Valley, you are very lucky. But if you live outside the Klang Valley, you will get some good palliative care services if you're in places like Ipoh or Penang. But if you're in some of the other areas, then it's less easy to access. And I think this is why we need to develop a national strategy. We need to see how we can envelop the whole country with palliative care services. And it's going to take time, it's going to take effort, it's going to take finance and resources and things which we have. But the question is that are we willing to commit these areas that I feel is crucial?
Because that would mean taking away money from managing other diseases, for an example.
I guess you might want to say you're taking away money, but I think if you audit what is useful and what is not useful, you might be able to divert some aspects of healthcare expenditure. One of the important developments in terms of public health was that in 2014, Malaysia actually is a signatory and to the World Health Assembly resolution on palliative care. And this is part of a framework where palliative care would be part of a universal healthcare coverage of that country. We are now trying to work that this becomes a document that the WHO fully wants to implement universally.
What's the biggest obstacle? Is it resources?
Resources is one aspect. One of the things is monitoring and quality indicators that this is something useful. One of the things that has been postulated will be the use of medications involved in pain management. Morphine would be one of the common ones, and our use of morphine in the country for pain management is actually quite low.
Okay,
I'm just wanting to go back to a fundamental question.
Sure.
Brought back by one of the things you pointed out earlier, which is concerning good quality and cost-effective palliative care.
Yes.
What does that actually look like? In order for us to respond, we ought to a standard. What is the standard?
What is the standard? What is it that you would want? And to me, when I talk to a patient, I start off by asking, what is it that you would want to get by us being involved with your care? You have pain. What is acceptable to you if the patient says, I don't want to feel any pain? Is that achievable? And I would say with good palliative care, 95% of all cancer pain could be relief. But it requires a couple of things. It requires expertise and it requires the medications to be made available to deal with that. Now, if you give me the expertise but don't give me the medication to deal with it, I can't do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And it is costly.
Yeah.
It's not costly.
It
it's
is
cheap.
Not, it is.
The drugs used for palliative care is extremely cheap.
Okay.
It's very, very cheap. You're talking about cents or one or two ringgits. You're not talking about the hundreds and the tens of thousands.
Most of it deals with pain management, right?
A lot of it deals with pain management. The other part of it, which we devalue, is the use of what you would... I don't like to use the word counselling, but psychological interventions, which can give a significant improvement on somebody's perception of life and quality of life. One of the things that patients crave for that can make a huge difference is actually information. We deny patients a great deal of information. When patients ask too many questions, sometimes they're asked to see a psychiatrist because they might be depressed or anxious, but actually they're interested in their own healthcare and their own well-being. And I encourage all my patients to ask as many questions as you want. And if it takes time, it's time well invested, because it's also your time and your life.
How do you manage families, though? You're managing the patient?
Patient and families.
Families, yes. Yeah. It's
interesting.
Yeah.
No, but that's a really important point to address.
Absolutely.
I mean, we talk about the patient every single time, but we don't, I think, speak enough about the caregivers, especially the family caregivers. Mm-hmm. Is there support for the family in terms of, you know, in the palliative care framework?
Earlier, you said that some of the things I said seem very new to you. Palliative care that started in the 1960s or so introduced things that are extremely different to medicine. One, the unit of care for palliative care is patient and family together, not just the patient. The family is an integral part of care. And we need to involve the family. So when you are sick, your family is affected. So I need to know how the illness has affected you and how the illness has affected the family. Somebody may have to look after you. The finances in dealing with the illness may have to be diverted in different areas. So we need to look after the whole family. And in terms of palliative care and kind of end-of-life situations, if the person passes away, the family is left behind, and sometimes they are grieving. They feel, have they done the best and have they done enough? And the care continues beyond that. So we continue to follow up with families after the death of the patient to see how they are coping.
A lot of Malaysians I know of or I've heard of want to die at home.
Absolutely.
How do we ensure that with palliative care they are able to do that?
That's a question that we are wanting to work with the Ministry of Health and others, as how do we ensure that people can do that. That's why one of the most difficult things is supporting community services like Hospice Malaysia and the others. We need people that are working with us to work with our community. Without that, you're going to have a very hospital-based system that looks at medicalizing various aspects of care. And so when patients can't cope, they essentially, whether they want to be at home or not, they can't deal with it and they have to send the patient to hospital. So we are very keen to see, we run workshops for caregivers to see, to teach them how they could manage people at home. Simple transfer techniques, bathing the patient at home, changing clothes, feeding, all these little skills which empower families and actually makes them feel that they are doing their bit in looking after their loved one. Much of these skills are not taught in hospitals.
I wanted to go back to a point that Mira made just now concerning the focus or the concentration of palliative-related services tend to be more on cancer-related services. So what should change? Because it seems to me that lobbying by patient advocacy groups is determining where the concentration of resources are, particularly when it comes to palliative care. Should the other diseases, the patient interest groups also lobby, or should it be much more generalized, in terms of palliative care?
The more the merrier, I would probably say. Cancer patient advocacy groups have been very strong in getting services. HIV communities across the world have managed to do a great deal. And palliative care has been stronger in cancer because there has been quite a lot of collaboration with cancer support groups. We're not reaching out as well, or those in other disease groups, the cardiovascular disease, the motor neuron disease, are not coming as much into the palliative care domain. HIV is another group that we've had difficulty dealing with. So although palliative care is amenable to so many NCDs, the patient groups, the other people there, haven't really wanting to be engaged with palliative care as much. One of the things that potentially is been stronger in the last few years is the need for pediatric palliative care.
Yes.
When the Duchess of Cambridge came over to visit Hospice Malaysia in 2012, one of the things we pushed forward was the recognition of the need for pediatric palliative care in the country.
And I can imagine even that has a long way to go then.
That has a long way to go. We've got a long way to go, Manny.
Okay. It's a good place to start, I suppose. We'll come back and find out up next. I don't know about Azrul, but I want to find out about treatment.
Absolutely.
So obviously medical people treating the patients are not talking to palliative care experts or people who look after them in end life. Question is, how do you have that conversation? It's obviously not happening. So when do you stop treatment, really? And then, move on to palliative care. So we'll come back and find out more. If you have a question for Dr. Ednin, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-1000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's our second episode of our public health series. Today we're discussing palliative care with Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, and Dr. Ednin Hamza, CEO of Hospice Malaysia. We're sort of trying to understand end-of-life care. We have a Twitter poll running. Should people with terminal disease be given end-of-life care? 85% say yes for quality of life. 15% say no, it's a waste of money. Since we're talking about costs, Dr. Ednin, does it cost a lot to... does palliative care cost a lot for individuals?
No, it doesn't. Absolutely not. The medication that we use is incredibly cheap. Investigations and such, we always look at things as what do you want that to for. We don't deal with what we call routine tests. Everything that we do has to have a purpose. Will it achieve the goal that we want to? So if you do not want a blood transfusion, I'm not going to check your blood count because you don't want to have anything regardless of the outcome. So I need to be thinking about, before I give you a treatment, is that what do you want to achieve? Is it acceptable? And therefore, full discussion into the indications for treatment, how long would it take to achieve its effect, and what hopeful goals will you have of it, is extremely important.
Hence that interaction with the patient is
absolutely
crucial.
Completely. Mm-hmm. It is the patient that is completely in control. And when you suggest about stopping treatment or whatever else, it's nothing about stopping treatment. It is actually about working together in that whatever treatment will achieve whatever purpose it might be, whether it is to control a symptom or will it slow down the disease or cure or whatever else.
But when we talk about cost, can I ask, is palliative care covered by SOCSO or insurance?
No.
That's going to be a problem, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about long-term duration of care that's going
to
cost.
I agree. I think that is something I would want to see in the future. But I feel that in order for it to be coverage, we need to be firm into what is the quality indicators of such a coverage. I agree. I think it's a very important thing. And we need to start having discussions with insurance companies as to how they would fund palliative care. But much of what I feel in terms of costs, especially in the community, is actually support for patients and caregivers. And it's having a someone who may not be physically able, so who's going to provide the care? Where families have got domestic helpers, sometimes they are used to provide care that they're not supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And then you have others who will hire private nurses. So these are potentially a higher amount of cost than most of the drugs that we use. The drugs are cheap. The question is that the drugs may be, for them to buy or purchase the drugs, the cost from the pharmaceutical outlet might be significantly higher than the cost price. And we have no control over that.
Okay. What about, we were talking about that conversation between the person treating the patient. Let's take cancer for an example. So the conversation between oncologist and professionals who are dealing with palliative care. That's obviously not happening at the moment. So question is, when does the oncologist stop treatment and who initiates that discussion?
I think the area of discussion, I'm not an oncologist, and to me, that decision should be between the oncologist and the patient. What I do is that I may ask both the oncologist and the patient is that what is this treatment hoping to achieve? Will it meet the potential goals that you're hoping for, or will it not? And sometimes you get the doctor saying, well, this is all that I can provide. And then you have got the patient and family said, miracles can happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, well, I haven't seen very many miracles happening yet. And I say, you need to be realistic as to what is possible. And sometimes I will say, there are other things that may be possible. The curative aspect may not be. I can hopefully make you pain-free. I can hopefully make you feel better, more comfortable, sleep better, feel psychologically better within yourself. Is that not good enough?
There is a word that resonates. Every time you talk about palliative care, this word comes along with it, which is dignity. So it seems to me that when it comes to palliative care, it's important that the person is able to be as much in the best possible way to have dignity, even towards the end of life. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
The area of dignity is a significant component of palliative care. And doctors are taught, junior doctors are taught that, you know, life-saving elements, the ABCD of cardiac resuscitation, airway, breathing, chest compression, and drugs are important. There is an ABCD as well in terms of dignity in palliative care. And it starts with your attitude towards these kind of patients. Are they patients of value? Or are they patients who you feel are going to die and are not worth the effort in doing anything with? So it starts with attitude. And then how do you behave towards these patients? And that's an action situation. The C is for compassion. And compassion requires two things. Compassion requires empathy and a willingness to do things maybe beyond what you're supposed to do. And the final one, D, is dialogue. The words that you use. Words make differences. People remember words. And if you do your ABCD properly in dignity-conserving care, your patients will know that you care. And it makes a big difference.
Dr. Aydin, would you say the earlier we seek palliative care and hospice care, the longer we will live and the higher our quality of life?
Yes, I would say yes, because that's something we have often talked about for years. But we didn't really have very much evidence until about 7 years ago, where where there was a study of cancer patients. And you had two groups of patients, one receiving standard oncology treatment, and the other one had oncology treatment plus palliative care. And what was found was that the patient receiving oncology and palliative care had better quality of life, better symptom control, and lived longer. And one of the sense was that because those receiving oncology care, what options were there was essentially oncology treatment. And sometimes it is hoping for the best, but sometimes some patients, maybe the treatment might not be the best thing for them. And without that treatment, they may live a bit longer. You could only use what's in front of you. You do not know what you don't have. And I guess sometimes somebody would say to me, how do I know that this treatment exists? And you don't until you open your eyes to searching to see what other options you have. And it requires doctors and other people to ask and not just accept what's in front of them, because there are things out there that you don't even know you have.
What are some key questions we should ask ourselves when it comes to palliative care or making that decision?
What's important in my life?
Right
now. What gives me meaning in my life, and how do I want to live my life and my health? Your decisions, plan longer term. People are very short term in their approach. If I am now potentially going to get older, maybe having various diseases, if I'm going to need palliative care in the next 5 or 10 years, who's going to do that for me? For myself and other activists, we're going to need your help. Because if the community doesn't support us, nobody else will. So the services that you want to have in the next 10 or 20 years of your life needs to be planned now. Mm-hmm. It can't be done when you need it. Just like planting a big tree to give you shade. It's never going to happen immediately. So the services that you want now for those in the 40s and 50s before you start getting diseases in your 60s and 70s, we're going to need your help, either through human resource, through funding, or putting pressure on policymakers, or become a policymaker yourself.
But I go back to support that point. What do you need? I mean, obviously, should there be a new law? You mentioned the national strategy, perhaps.
You can.
The ministry perspective.
Legislation can be quite useful. Countries like Taiwan has got legislation that virtually guarantees citizens for palliative care. Affordability of healthcare, putting it into universal health coverage, would then make it a lot easier for insurance companies to provide coverage for palliative care. So legislation would certainly be one way. Providing funding to organizations that provide palliative care would be another way of doing things. At the lowest point, volunteering and seeing what you can do to support palliative care would be another way of doing things.
We're running out of time. Can we have a message on palliative care, Dr. Ednan, and just moving forward in terms of policy? How do we move from here? It's been an enlightening discussion, but what now?
I would say look out for palliative care. You're going to need it. Support us. There are initiatives that we will come out with. We want you to know and seeing what you can do to help us.
Thank you both very much for joining us today. Thanks for co-hosting Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, as well as Dr. Ednan Hamza, CEO of Hospice Malaysia, discussing end-of-life care on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.